Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It is Thursday, February 23rd, 2017. Welcome, everyone. We have two items on today's agenda. One is an informational hearing on the health effects of diesel emissions, and the other is a public hearing on Senate Bill 643. I'm going to go out of order. I hope nobody minds, but we're going to start with the public hearing on Senate Bill 643, hear the testimony on that, and then reserve the remainder of today's hearing for the informational hearing. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 643, and I'd like Senator Manas Anderson and Shauna Wellman, if you could both come up. And as they're getting themselves seated, Beth, could you please tell us what Senate Bill 643 does?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 643 would require anyone 17 years of age and younger who's either operating a boat or is a passenger in a boat on any section of water rated class 3 or higher to wear a properly secured helmet.
And Mr. Chair, before we get started, for the record, I'm over here because he's sick.
I'm borderline.
If I could be farther down, I would be. But
as a nurse, you should not be here, Senator Dembrough. All right. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, I'm State Senator Lori Monis Anderson. I represent East Multnomah County, Gresham, Fairview, Troutdale, and Wood Village, and I'm delighted to bring before you Senate Bill 643. It's about river rafting, and I love river rafting, and I have rafted the Deschutes, and I have also rafted the Rogue, and have spent overnights, and it's always a family affair, and it's a wonderful opportunity. Shauna and Robert Burge brought this idea to me. Sharon Burge is Shauna's mother, and Robert's wife was died due to an accident while rafting, and I'm going to let her tell the story. But I know, I feel strongly that we need to have some more safety standards for river rafting. I remember one time when my daughter, who was probably around 15 at the time, fell, it was on the Deschutes, our raft capsized, and I was very concerned because when we all popped up, I could not find her, and I thought that she had hit her head on the on the rock, and of course she wasn't wearing a helmet. No, she was actually trapped underneath the raft, and so I just feel that this is a good bill, and I would hope that you look favorably on it. And I think Representative Gorsuch
has been promoted.
A few
I'm
words
following.
To say also.
Representative Gorsuch, welcome.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Chris Gorsuch. I am the House Representative for District 49, which is the north side of Senator Monis Anderson's. Robert Burge, I believe that's correctly. Okay. Robert Burge is a constituent of mine, and he and his daughter, Shauna, Wellman Burge, approached both Senator Monis Anderson and myself to work on this legislation. The idea was to address some of the safety issues that had led to the death of Robert's wife and Shauna's mother, Sharon. After looking into industry standards and speaking with other rafting outfitters, it became apparent that offering helmets to adults and requiring them for children was standard practice. After looking into the outfitter that failed to offer the minimum standard to that family that the industry calls for, we found that they were also out of compliance in terms of reporting the death of one of their clients to the Oregon's Marine Board. So having this modest standard reflected in statute, we feel would not only protect families like the Burges, it would also mean that the outfitter or rental firm would have further motivation and reason to ensure a safety standard that is reasonable and pervasive in most other active sports. So, and I did not do this for effect.
I actually
was walking my dog and tripped on a raised piece of sidewalk. So this is not.
Do we need the helmet for that?
I think I do, actually. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm available for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Shauna, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair Denbrow and the other members of the committee. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 643. I also want to thank Senator Manas Anderson and Representative Gorsuch for bringing this to your attention. We really appreciate all that.
Shauna, if you could give us your name.
Yes, my name is Shauna Wellman, and my address is 14628 Southeast 130th Drive, Clackamas, Oregon, 97015. I represent my family, including my father and my two sons and myself. My family is here in support of Senate Bill 643 in memory of my mother, Sharon Birch. On July 6, 2015, our family, including my two children who were 6 and 8 at the time, went on a whitewater rafting trip down the Deschutes in Maupin. It was a commercial whitewater rafting trip. My mom had purchased this trip on Groupon as an opportunity to take her family out on a whitewater rafting excursion, her husband, her daughter, and her grandkids included. You can still find this item selling on Groupon. It's a 3-hour trip designed to be an excellent introduction to river rafting. They state that the guides provide everything that you need, the supplies that you need, including life jackets, oars, paddles, dry bags, frames, and ropes. Tragically for our family, there was one item that was missing from this excursion, helmets. We were going through a Class 3 rapid when our boat tipped sideways. My mom, Sharon, was forcefully thrown from one side of the boat to the other, and she hit her head inside the boat. Sharon suffered severe brain trauma from this incident and was taken to Mid-Columbia Medical Center via ambulance. She was quickly evaluated and they found swelling and bleeding on her brain. And she was categorized as a trauma patient and immediately life-flighted to OHSU. She was in a coma during her entire hospitalization and she died 10 days later after the accident. My mom was in the care of Dr. Tucker at OHSU during her hospitalization. Unfortunately, Dr. Tucker is not able to be here today. But she has provided a statement that I've attached to my testimony. Dr. Tucker felt very strongly that if Sharon would have been wearing a helmet that day, that she would still be alive today. My mom was scheduled to retire just a few weeks after this excursion. She was employed at Boeing Portland for 42 years. During this time at Boeing, she was in charge of safety. Her motto was safety first. All five of us would have had a helmet on if they would have been offered to us, whether it was the law or not. She would have been an example to everybody on that trip. A couple things that Dr. Tucker mentions in her statement that's attached that seem to be important to me are that over 28,000 head injuries due to water sports were treated in U.S. emergency departments in 2009, and that number is growing. Helmets dissipate and distribute the energy a brain suffers from traumatic impact, providing an outward hard shell and an inner cushion to protect the brain from deformation as it crashes into the skull from outward impact. The recommendation is especially poignant for the young brain, the brain that is particularly vulnerable at a time when it is still developing and the future of its neurons and their connections are yet unknown. And there's much more information on here from Dr. Tucker. The cost of these injuries, aside from life, are numerous. The financial cost of this trauma was over $300,000 at OHSU alone. That does not include the ambulance transport, CT scans, and care at Mid-Columbia Medical or the life flight from the Dalles to OHSU. With this money, we estimate that over 6,000 helmets could have been purchased. The current situation in Oregon, helmets are required for bikes and scooters for kids under the age of 18. Our zip lining companies require helmets for participation, and in many cases, helmets are not being offered by commercial rafting companies in the state of Oregon, including the company that we were with. What we are asking is that all commercial rafting companies have helmets available to all participants, and that persons 17 age or younger on commercial rafting excursions are required to wear helmets. Who would regulate this? We would suggest the State Marine Board, the Oregon State Police, County Sheriffs, who are already regulating the safety on the rivers with life vests. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 643. Do you have any questions for me?
Thank you, Shama. Thank you for sharing that story.
You're welcome.
Yes, Senator Robles.
The only question I have is I agree. I think it should, having rafted a lot of times, not wearing a helmet. And I am here today, thankfully. It's not any reason for me, because once you get out of the boat in the water, you kind of are on your own, and been there a few times. So the question I have is, this doesn't say commercial, so would this be, if I'm operating my own boat and I have guests on it or a raft and we're going to shoot a rapid that's a three, would we be required to have the helmets as well? Because I think it probably should be. I just don't know that it, I can't tell in this bill if it only does commercial or if it does everybody.
And I would need to check with LC to see if that was indicated, so we'd have to have that clarified.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think it means everybody. Mm-hmm. The way I went when I first read it, because it just, it doesn't signify one kind of the other.
Right.
So, but it means that, besides, because we are required to have life jackets.
Right.
So if that is the case, then we've got to, I mean, there's a bigger group of people out there that need to know that if they're going to go do this stuff, they should have helmets with them.
Right. Well, we will definitely check into that and confirm.
But I agree, absolutely, those commercial people who are taking you out and making you believe you're going to have a wonderful experience. And in general, that's probably true, but mm-hmm. it doesn't take much, as you've shown. And that one, they didn't even get thrown out of the boat into the water. It was not a rock. It was part of the...
She was actually in the boat.
All
yes.
The time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Actually, I have a question. In doing your research for the bill, did you come across any other states that have requirements for helmets on rapids?
Jason did some research mm-hmm. on that, and I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have it with me here, so but we can get that to you.
Wonder, yeah, that would be good to know.
Sure.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Olson.
In doing your research for the bill, did you talk with the Marine Board?
Yes.
As to the ability to enforce this?
Yes. Is anybody from the Marine Board
yes.
here today? Okay,
we
so we did talk to them, and I believe they're going to come up and testify mm-hmm. about that.
Okay, great. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
All right.
So let me bring up Aaron Lieberman and Stan Steele, please.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Can we, I'm sorry, I had testimony just like Senator Mona Sanderson. I was actually in her committee while she's over here testifying. I was over there. So I'm curious. I've looked at what Senator Roland brought forward as to whether it applies. I guess another question, and maybe this was in the presentation from Beth during her summary. It says a person operating a boat on any section of waters that are rated a class 3 or higher. The question I would have, is that just for going through the rapid as compared to, because it has a class 3, I do a lot of rafting, and the only, you know, the ones that we do at the Grand Canyon, you have to have it, and mm-hmm. you know, buckle down and all like that, but we do 3s and 4s without that, and I just want some clarification if it means or is intent to mean, just because it's just class 3, you have to wear one, or is it only going through the rapid?
I would assume it's only going through the rapid.
Well,
but
the way it's written,
maybe, it's hard to read that
maybe
again.
It needs
I
to
would
be
have
clearer.
To agree with him that it's
the way it's written.
Yeah.
So.
I assume that's the intent.
I'll follow you.
Okay. Sorry, gentlemen. Thank you. Whoever wants to go first.
All right. My name is Aaron Lieberman. I'm from Grants Pass, and I am the operations manager for Orange Torpedo Trips. We're a rafting and kayaking outfitter operating in Oregon as well as Idaho and Northern California. So I'm here today on behalf of Orange Torpedo Trips, also to some extent representing other outfitters that we've discussed this with in the industry. I sort of put together, Brian Sykes put together a list here of our stance and stance that I also support, which is that there is insufficient evidence to support the idea that there are rampant or inordinate number of head injuries that occur in specifically Class 3 rapids. So in a way, we're, the law would arguably there would be a solution in search of a problem, empirically speaking. Additionally, helmets don't protect from heat. They could probably exacerbate it, and that's really a much more common and serious issue for us. Whereas, you know, if you're wearing a hat or anything else, just in the water, actually keeps you cool. And finally, that unnecessary safety equipment sometimes or has been known to ultimately have negative social consequences within that activity, because it gives people an undue sense of confidence in what they're able to do. So they might take on rapids or dangers that they would otherwise avoid. And then finally, I can speak only for Orange Torpedo Trips, but I, you know, in the industry as a whole, we do uphold our own industry standards or our own company standards and come together at outfitter meetings to discuss industry standards and safety and training techniques to prevent things like this from happening. So.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Mr. Steele.
Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, committee members, my name is Dan Steele. I've been a member of the Mackenzie River Guides and an active guide up until I retired from that just a few years ago. And you know, we're saddened as an industry anytime there's an injury of any sort, and specifically when there's a fatal injury, our heart goes out to the family. I mean, what can you say? But all outdoor sports have an inherent risk value assigned to them, whether we're golfing and get struck by a lightning bolt, which has occurred, or whether we're hunting and have an accidental discharge of a weapon. They're tragic events anytime they occur, and I want that to be, you know, I mean, I just really, we have to make sure everybody does understand that we're here representing an industry, but it's not a heartless industry. What normally goes on in a pre-flight, or a pre-float in this case, and I've literally had thousands of customers, and the organization that I work with and represent, the Mackenzie River Guide Association, has had tens of thousands of customers. We've run everything from the Middle Fork of the Salmon, Lower Main, the Rogue, I mean, some really very technical waters. We pride ourselves in running the best trip and the safest trip, because everything we do is built on safety, because obviously it's an insured event. In other words, we pay an insurance. We want to make sure that these trips are safe. We undergo extensive whitewater training. We're all CPR. We're all first aid certified. It's a requirement, a base requirement. We've actually throw bags on our boats. You just won't find a legitimate guide boat that is not prepared for the worst. First aid kits. First aid kits are always on board. So I think that helmets are something that we can talk at length about. When do we need them? You read the bill, and specifically the interpretation I would have is that it only is required when they're going through a Class 3, not a half mile above or not a quarter mile below. Okay, so then we have to get in, who determines Class 3s? What is the standard? There really is a variable standard there. At 1,300 CFS, in other words, flow per minute, it could be a 1. At 1,500 or whatever, it could be a 3. The eye of the needle. Some of these rapids that we talk about that actually go from placid, flat water to Class 5s, depending on water heights. Those judgments will change daily. And those daily changes are actually what we expect our highly trained guides, in most cases, to analyze. So you're going to have an enforcement dilemma there. A police officer, which I used to be, Oregon State Police Trooper, working in these type of issues, your judgment against the guide's judgment. And most definitely I would defer to the guide's judgment for the fact he's there every day. That was one of the things we prided ourselves on, is we ran a boat. And I actually taught for the State Marine Board in whitewater sled boat operation for several years, and our safety issues that we, you know, had to train our deputies and our other troopers on. So the issue, I understand. It's not bad to say we have to analyze all safety equipment. But I'm not sure that when we start to look at the complication of when we have to require, that's required to be worn and when it's not, I think we're going to, it's really difficult. It's not like a bicycle where we, say a child is going to have that on 100% of the time. The way it's written, there's some exceptions there now. I can see a real enforcement nightmare coming up out of this. Some areas, some rivers, such as the Rogue and others, you have no other access. So unless an enforcement officer is there, how is it going to be equally applied? First aid response, let's use the McKenzie River for example. We have an incredible system built on the McKenzie with our search and rescue and McKenzie River Rural Fire. We have boats at the Leeburg substation, and those boats are immediately available if there's an accident. And one of the key areas on the McKenzie where we have accidents is called Martin Rapids. Ran it 14 times when I was 14 years old, and we wanted to tip over all 14 times. That was our whole sole purpose in a rubber raft. And you know, some folks would say, boy, that was reckless. But it was a hot summer day, and that was the way we did things back then. And I'm sure that you're still seeing that going on. I see it on a yearly basis up there, people with the purpose of getting into the water, from getting thrown out. That doesn't lessen the safety, but I think we have to be very cautious and sympathetic towards the family. I mean, I truthfully, this is a dilemma for you. What's the cost of the industry? It's going to be huge. There is going to be a fiscal assigned to this. There just has to be. These helmets aren't cheap, and right now, on a pre-float, we size every person that comes on to our boats, give them the proper life jacket for their size, make sure that it's secured. We talk about how to get people back in the boat if they fall out. You don't grab a limb, we stretch, we grab the collars of our jackets. You don't drag them in backwards. Our backs don't bend that way. We bring it, all this is stuff that we go into what we call our pre-float. So I think it's a well-intended, but I think there's some consequences that we have to explore further, possibly with amendments or just further discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, that was Steele. Any questions? Yes, Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aaron, to you, when folks come and sign up for Orange Torpedoes and they're filling out the paperwork and everything, is there a point in that paperwork where you disclose that there's some inherited risks to floating the river and just kind of, because one thing I have learned since I've been in the Senate is not everybody has had the same experiences I have had in life and don't understand that, and that you actually have to tell them, you know, there are some inherited risks in floating the lower Rogue. There's no question about it. It was just several years ago we had somebody drown down there at Teapot, or tea kettle or whatever.
Coffee pot.
God, that's it. And had a life jacket on. Caffeine. Had everything, you know. So there's some inherited risks, and we really need to make people aware of that. So do you have that in your, when they sign up?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. There are inherent risks. But, I mean, as he was saying as well, and we do have that in our liability release. It's also something that we really stress in the pre-trip safety discussion. You know, like many of our trips take place in wilderness areas, but even for those that don't, you know, we just reiterate to people, you are engaging in an inherently risky activity. Go over some of the contingencies, some of these specific contingencies. You know, it's like what happens if the raft flips, what that means, so on and so forth. But yeah, we do reinforce that understanding with people, as much toward the purpose of their handling themselves more carefully. There are statistics out there. It always changes exactly what percentage, but they say 90. We always say 90% of accidents on the river happen within 10 feet of the bank. So you know, down to the point of saying, when you're walking along the bank, just take extra care. Don't just fumble along. Look where you're going, and everything that you do on the river, make sure that you're present and conscious of what you're doing. So, to your question, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Quickly, because we'll have to move on.
I know. Everybody should have a chance. When you go out to raft and you observe the water, is it easy for you to tell if you're going to come upon a typical class 3 that's on there, or do you have enough experience to know that we're going to hit that class 3 today, or it's going to be a class 1 because the water's down?
Yeah, I would say we do, definitely. I mean, the river is necessarily a variable thing. It's inherently unpredictable, but we do have some measures for predictability, such as looking at volume. Those objective measures coupled with experience, which I can only speak for our company, but our average head guide tenure is 15 years. We have some guides who've been with us for 40 years. But so that those objective measures, flow in particular, coupled with experience, should give any commercial guide an idea of what's coming up and what the rough classification of that is. Although again, as was mentioned, those classifications are subjective and depend and contingent on water level and other factors. So,
follow up. Do people that don't hire guides, do they go do it themselves?
Yes.
And would they have the experience to know if they're going to come upon a class three?
It's a case by case. The private boating community, private non-motorized boating community, is a really big tent. I would hope so. But, you know, so I think many of the unfortunate tragedies that we do see any given year in Oregon and nationally largely come down to, and I think actually Randy from the Marine Board can speak to that as well, but largely come down to inexperience or lack of understanding or lack of knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Dimbrough, Senator Olson, just briefly on that, is there is absolutely no question that when we look at our industry compared to the general public, where the most safety is applied. Most of our guides, we had a meeting recently and we even chuckled that, gosh, we're all old and gray anymore. In other words, the years of experience are just in the hundreds. Now, that isn't true with all outfits, and that's one of the things that we've stressed is to make sure even in, we've worked on this to make sure that we do have a safer industry by saying there's requirements in place now for training and all of this. So I think that industry is self-analyzing all the time, always trying to get better. As I said, it's a horrible tragedy. Preventable, you know, that's always going to be debatable, and accidents just happen. But we would be very willing to work with all and committee members and the Marine Board to analyze these types of issues and say, how can we make it better, and possibly not have to have legislation to do that, but self-regulate. I think it's a better way to go on a lot of these issues.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. Okay, both of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up our three remaining people who signed up. Randy Henry, Arthur Towers, and Val Sean.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Randy Henry. I'm the Boating Safety Program Manager for the Oregon State Marine Board. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some input on Senate Bill 643. The bill would amend Marine Board statutes to require persons 17 and under who are operating boats and who are passengers in a boat on sections of waters rated Class 3 or higher to wear a helmet. The Marine Board has no position on this bill. However, since it would be a change to ORS 830, we would have the responsibility to educate the public and enforce the requirement. Current law requires mandatory life jacket wear when operating in Class 3 whitewater rapids or higher. This applies to everyone on the boat, so it is easy to identify as a boat passes whether the law is being followed. The age requirement for the helmet law would be a bit more difficult for law enforcement to assess who is in the raft, who in the raft is required to wear the helmet or not. The Marine Board contracts with 32 county sheriff's offices and the Oregon State Police for marine law enforcement services across the state. For some context, there have been 27 citations and two warnings under the mandatory life jacket law on Class 3 whitewater between 2012 and 2016. That's probably the closest parallel to this. So I bring this forward just as an idea of what this might look like on the enforcement end. So that's 27 citations and two warnings over a five-year period statewide. This is partly due to the good compliance rates on these waters. If you sit and watch the rafts go down the Deschutes, you will see a lot of life jackets in use. But it's also difficult to enforce laws on whitewater rivers. To cite violators, law enforcement must observe them going through a rapid and then contact the boat somewhere downstream. The Marine Board does not have a dedicated funding, does not have dedicated funding for non-motorized enforcement. While some enforcement does occur in predominantly non-motorized areas, patrols either need to occur from shore or they're from a similarly typed non-motorized boat that is working its way downriver, so contacts are limited to those in the vicinity as the officer progresses downstream. So a little more on those 27 citations. Of the 27 citations for failure to wear a life jacket on a Class 3 or higher rapids, they have all 27 of those were made by Wasco County on the Deschutes River. That's of 36 counties statewide, 22 that we're contracted with. The reason for this is that some whitewater areas on the Deschutes are easily accessible from the road that parallels much of the river, and the officer can witness the violation and then contact the boater at the put-in downstream. Additionally, though, boater pass dollars generated from the permit fees fund law enforcement services on the wild and scenic section of the Deschutes River, allowing that type of focused enforcement in this specific area. It's also easy to anticipate when and where high usage rates will occur there. The Marine Board is certainly an advocate for safe boating and supports boaters being properly equipped, scouting ahead, and having the skills to operate in the area where they are boating. We'll enforce the laws as best to our ability and make every effort to educate the public in normal course of duties. The Marine Board lacks funding for targeted enforcement on non-motorized boating or specific education, but we'll work within our normal patrols to carry out these functions. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, why don't we ask Randy questions now, because there may be technical things we want to hear. Senator Roblin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you read this bill, does it require every person under 17 to have a helmet whenever they get on a raft or whatever, if there's a Class 3, or just in general?
It would be in the area of a Class 3. The way that we functionally enforce, that question came up with the life jacket requirement in Class 3 whitewater. We had that discussion because it's a little bit vague, but the functionality is we're going to look at the place of the rapids where the risk is occurring.
Okay.
So that's where the citations occur. You sit at the rapids, you watch somebody go through, you make contact with them.
Technical.
And let me follow up to that. So, you know, since you have a somewhat similar requirement, you know, for the life jackets, have you had challenges determining where it's Class 3? Because we heard some potential challenges there.
Yes, Chair Dembrough. That's a good question. That question has been hypothetically raised, you know, given flows, times of the year, changes to a rapids, how do you know it's still a Class 3? The language in the statute says that commonly determined Class 3. So you look at the book Soggy Sneakers, some of those, they will outline, they'll give you maps and note what generally the rapids are considered in that area. We discussed trying to have that a little more active of a determination, but it gets extremely complicated because rivers rise and fall and things change all the time. So what's a Class 2 today might be a Class 3 if the water is either lower or higher. So we just go with that commonly described system, and which results in officers, I think, looking for something that is a clear violation. They're not going to sit there and say, well, that could be a 2, I'm not sure, but I'll go ahead and cite. No, they will go to one that's definitely meets that definition of a 3, and that's where they will spend their energy. That's how we see it implemented anyway.
Senator Brzezinski.
So you brought up Soggy Sneakers, which is kind of the book we use, but there's other books, there's other rating systems on different rivers for different rapids. Which one are we going to use?
We had that same question. That's why we used that. That's why the term in the 2007 legislation, I guess, that required the Class 3 life jacket law to go down the road of trying to figure out which book is the authority and which one is kept up to date. We went with that term, commonly accepted scale, and that's it's a little bit vague. Yes, it is. So it's any of those books that are out there that are commonly accepted.
Senator Olson.
Randy, in this regulation, it's one I'm very familiar with because I own a boat. What is your definition of boat? Is it a licensed registered boat, or could it be a raft?
A boat is anything that provides transport. I don't know. I can't remember the exact definition, but it's anything that provides transportation on the water that is not like a pool toy, an inner tube or an air mattress or that sort of thing. It would be a raft. It would be whether it's a, you know, 6-foot Sevilar fish hunter or a much nicer neoprene type of raft or something like that. Those would all be considered boats. If it was a single inner tube like the river rat inner tubes that are so popular out there, that would not be considered a boat.
Follow-up? Mm-hmm. Do we actually have a definition of what a boat is in statute?
Yes, I can read it to you.
No, you don't have to.
Yeah, it's in statute.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, you know, I like you said, the definition of the rapids. I mean, what are we going to do? Are we going to put up signs and say this is the beginning of the Class 3, this is the end? And sometimes those rapids are extended over a long period of the river, and there's places in between those rapids that are not really Class 3. I think that's going to be really hard to interpret this particular law in a courtroom. Very hard.
Again, I would follow up. How does it work with the life jacket issue? I mean, because it sounds like it's parallel.
I don't believe Chair Dembro, I don't believe we've had challenges. I think of those 27 citations, they were issued and worked their way through the process because, again, they're looking at a piece of water that is very clear. And some of those rapids are actually popular with photographers to take pictures as the guides go through them. So there's usually photographic evidence related to that. So again, it's sort of the safe bet to go with the known rapids in that particular section. And they're usually dealing with one specific section. I looked through the two warnings that were issued. One was on the Rogue, one was on the, I think it was the McKenzie River in Lane County. And it was believed that the individual went through a rapids without the life jacket on, but it wasn't. There was some doubt in it, so they simply issued the warning and did education.
And of those 28 citations, were they predominantly outfitters, or were they predominantly private individuals? Do you know?
I believe they were, Chair Dembro, I believe they were predominantly private operators. I would have to go back and count that, but I believe they were predominantly private operators.
Mr. Chair, if I could do one last clarification. According to the bill, and I believe that it states that when you go through the Class 3, you have to have a helmet on. So would it be legal for them to just carry the helmets along? And my question is once they get to that Class 3, do they have opportune time to put their helmet on before they go through it? I just see some logistical problems with this other than having to wear their helmet through the entire float trip, which most people don't want to do.
Yeah. Chair Dembro, Senator Olson. Probably it would be similar. My conjecture would be it'd be similar to the life jacket law, where if it's a hot day, a lot of folks would keep the life jacket off and put it on before they enter the rapids. They would put the helmet on before they enter the rapids. So again, it's additional equipment in the boat that you're going to have to keep track of and put on at the correct time to make that determination.
Okay, thank you, Andy. Arthur, go right.
Okay. My name's Val Shaw. I got my outfitter license guide in 1979. I'm no longer an outfitter, but I do teach rafting at Reed College, and I help guide with energy kayaking in Oregon City. I was a fireman for almost 30 years, too. So I'm pretty much into safety, and I've seen over the years accidents where people have banged their heads together or hurt themselves. As far as wearing the helmets and not wearing them, on the White Salmon River in Washington, it can be 100 degrees out, and the outfitters make you wear a wetsuit, a life jacket, and a helmet. And people don't like to wear that wetsuit because it's hot. But once they get into that cold water, they realize why they are wearing that wetsuit. And I tell people about helmets and life jackets, did you come over here to raft, or did you come over here to get a suntan? You know, if you want to raft, put your life jacket on, put your helmet on, and, you know, let's do it safely. And especially with kids, they're dear to my heart. I have some. And the cost, they're around, anywhere from $40 up to $100, but, you know, the lady just said how much it cost, you know, her mom to go to the hospital, and that's a lot. So anyway, I am for wearing helmets. It's, you know, it helps, and we don't want to have somebody hurt. I think the companies, you know, once they get them, you know, it's like life jackets. Once you get them, you have them, they work, and maybe your insurance will go down a little bit. If you don't have them, it could go up. So, and you could be more liable without helmets. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Shaw. Okay, Arthur, I saved you for last because I know you'll be brief. Thank you.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm proud to be the political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Our members wanted to be represented on this issue because our members see the impact of serious injuries on a regular basis. They see how a serious injury can, or a death, as was described, can change the arc of the life of a family. Taking a loved one away like that is very, very difficult. And I really commend Ms. Wellman and Mr. Burge and the family that's here today for having the courage to come forward and tell their story. Very difficult thing to do. And the fact that they're here to make sure that no other family has to go through the tragedy they went through is really you know, needed in this state, clearly from the conversation today. So I thank them. We want to stand up for safety. It's way better, again, having seen all these injuries, we know that preventing the injuries is the right thing to do. Our members contribute to a bike helmet program where they give away properly fitted bike helmets to kids in need. And so we want to do everything we can to prevent the injuries in the first place. But I also want to dwell for a second on the issue of accountability, because we've heard today the offensive comment that this is a solution in search of a problem. I think there's a number of people in this room today who can tell you quite clearly and have told you quite clearly what the problem is. I think that it's good to understand that you have different types of operators doing different sorts of things. We had one operator come up and talk about whitewater training, first aid kits, throw bags, different types of certification. They have reputable and experienced guides out in the field, and that a lot of them have gray hair. But what about the ones that aren't reputable, that aren't experienced? And how are we going to hold the ones who aren't doing the right things accountable? Again, going back to the comment, this is a solution in search of a problem. Know that in other committees in this building earlier this month, we had the outdoor recreation industry trying to claim that immunity from responsibility for injuries was critical to their success of growing the industry in this state. And so, in my opinion, they can't have it both ways. They can't be in here lobbying against child safety provisions while at the same time saying things are so dangerous, you know, there's so many injuries, we have to be immune from liability. And so I urge the passage of this bill. I urge you to stand up for child safety. I think that's an important issue, and I appreciate Representative Gorsuch, Senator Montes Anderson, and the sponsors, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Director.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, just one question, then we're over time.
It'll be one with seven sections. No, when you made two comments that really struck me. You want to hold somebody accountable, but prior to that you said a properly fitted helmet. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have a group of teenagers out there, how many? If you had 10 teenagers, would you have any idea how many helmets you would need to have to make sure that certain that each helmet was exactly properly fitted? Because as a trial lawyer, if something happened, you would hold them accountable if it wasn't properly fitted.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Olson, I don't know the answer to your question about how many helmets would be needed, but what I would say is that an outfitter that took the time to find a helmet, provide a helmet, provide the safety provisions that were talked about by the previous, by some of the previous witnesses, would have a lot more protection from liability than the folks that took out Ms. Wellman's mother.
And they are adjustable.
The helmets are?
Yes.
The straps are, but I don't know the...
Yeah, they're,
yeah,
they're,
they are. The inside is, yeah.
Like a football helmet?
They can be.
Yeah.
No, different than a football helmet, they're, but yeah, more adjustable than a football helmet.
Yeah. There's multiple styles.
Okay, we've got to move on. But thank you. Thank you, all three of you,
thank
for
you.
Coming up. And let me say that we will consult with the sponsors of this bill, talk to them about potential amendments. We've learned a lot today. And see where we want to go next. Thank you, everyone who came forward. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 643, and I'm going to open our informational meeting on diesel emissions health effects. And I'll call up the first panel is Perry Heisted and William Lambert. If you could both come up. And as they're coming up, just to give you some background, as many of you know, we've had a work group that's been looking at issues related to diesel and looking for ways to move us more quickly away from the older diesel engines, which had high emission rates, to engines that were built after the year 2007, which are much, much cleaner. the result of that work, we have a bill that we just finally yesterday received the final legislative concept. And so we're about to get that distributed to task force member, work group members, and start the process of getting it introduced. That we'll have a hearing on that bill on March 8th. 2 weeks from yesterday. But it made sense to me, before we get into the solutions, to get a better understanding of the problem of, why are diesel emissions an issue? And are they an issue everywhere, or do they have a sort of place-based component to them? Where certain neighborhoods, certain parts of the state, et cetera, are more affected than others. We've assembled some experts, first from academia and then from our agencies, to help us to understand this. So with that, Drs. Heisted or Lambert, whoever wants to go first.
Sure, I think you should go first.
All right. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, thanks for allowing me to testify today. So for the record, my name is Perry Heisted. I'm an assistant professor at Oregon State University. And I was asked to give a testimony on the health effects of diesel. So this will really be a high-level, 10,000-foot overview of what we know about diesel and its health effects. So it's important to start off just with an overview of what is diesel and why is it unique. So diesel is not a specific type of pollution, but rather it's a specific source. And this source results in a unique mixture of gases and particles, which is shown here in the upper left. So diesel particles are composed of a solid carbon core that is covered with organic metals and other toxic components. So it's estimated that over 40 of these different components are classified as hazardous air pollutants or toxic air contaminants. The size of diesel particles is also very important to their health risk. So the distributions that are shown in the bottom left are sizes of particles resulting from diesel emissions. These range from fine to ultrafine to nanoparticles. So for comparison, these are the approximate ranges of molecules, viruses, or bacteria. So these are extremely small particles that you can breathe deeply into your lungs. It's also important to mention
Senator DeDebro highlighted, that diesel emissions have changed greatly over time. So the figure in the top left shows reductions in NOx and PM, and this is by model year for on-road heavy-duty vehicles. So in 2007, there was a new standard for PM that was enacted, and this was 10 times lower than the next or the previous regulations for PM. So to meet this, engine manufacturers employ diesel particulate filters, which are shown in the top right, and these are very effective at reducing particulates and the other toxic components of diesel. And really, to illustrate this, on the bottom are four filters. So this is collecting air that result from diesel emissions, moving from uncontrolled diesel exhaust to the diesel particle filter on the right. So you can just see the difference in the particles that are collected on those filters resulting from those technologies. So the health summary that I'll be presenting, most of that health research is actually from diesel engines prior to 2007. That's where most of the research has been conducted. So this is really representing the older, not new technology, diesel emissions. So there's been actually over 60 years of research on diesel. In terms of a complex environmental mixture, it's probably second only to tobacco smoke in terms of the amount of research that's been done looking at this mixture. Here's an example of just three comprehensive assessments. They seem to all come in at around 700 pages, so some nice light reading. But this really demonstrates the body of research that has been put into this area. Everything from the first EPA health assessment in 2002 to the International Agency for Research on Cancer's report in 2012 to a recent HEI report looking at what new technology clean diesel actually means for reduced emissions and health. So in general, the health impacts of diesel come from animal studies, human experiment studies, and observational research. So I'm an environmental epidemiologist, so I'll mostly be focusing on some of the human experiment and epidemiology that that we know of. And it's also important to note that while most of the diesel-specific epidemiology comes from occupational studies, and I think Dr. Lambert will be talking about those in more detail, there have been thousands of studies that look at specific air pollutants that are found in diesel exhaust, such as fine particles, NO2, benzene, PAHs. So we can use this research to draw some conclusions on the overall health impact of diesel. So in 2012, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified diesel engine exhaust as carcinogenic to humans. So while they concluded that there was sufficient evidence for carcinogenicity from animal studies, this classification was really driven by three occupational studies. So looking at diesel exhaust exposure in non-metal miners and truck drivers. And that graph at the bottom shows the relationship between the relative risk of lung cancer mortality and elemental carbon, which is a marker used to assess how much diesel that you're actually exposed to. So as elemental carbon goes up, relative risk of lung cancer also goes up. How we translate that into lower concentrations that we experience in the overall ambient environment has received a lot of debate, and I think we'll be talking about that later. So it's also worth highlighting in that other table, this is looking at outdoor fine particles and their relationship to lung cancer. So this is 16 independent studies found that for a 10-unit increase in fine particles, the risk of lung cancer increases by 9%. So this is just another body of evidence showing the impacts of outdoor air pollution. So when we move to respiratory health effects, there's strong evidence for diesel impacts on lung inflammation, decreased lung function. This is especially in children, asthma, acute bronchitis, and increased susceptibility to respiratory infections. So the study on the left, this is a study that looked at air pollution from truck traffic. So this was the amount of trucks on a road within 300 meters of a children's house, and then they measured lung function. So you can see as the number of trucks goes up, forced expiratory volume goes down. So this is a measure of lung function. Another interesting study looked at what happened when you adopted clean fuels or technologies on school buses and what this meant for the kids who rode those school buses in terms of respiratory health. So this was an interesting study where they measured markers of lung function on kids that rode a bus before it was retrofitted, and then for those same kids driving on the same routes, markers of their lung inflammation after that retrofit happened. And you can see here especially for ultra-low sulfur diesel, there was a large reduction in exhaled nitric oxide. So this is a marker of airway inflammation. And this was especially pronounced for those kids who already had asthma. So if you were a kid who had asthma and you rode on one of these buses that was then retrofitted, you saw much greater improvement in markers of your lung inflammation. So a novel way to look at potential health impacts. Cardiovascular effects. So there's really a rapidly growing body that looks at the association between air pollution in general and cardiovascular disease. And there's strong evidence specifically for fine particles, so PM2.5. And that evidence is summarized in this table here. So this is different cardiovascular outcomes ranging from stroke to heart attacks, as well as different clinical markers of risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Three arrows indicates that there's strong evidence, two arrows moderate, and one arrow weak. So you can see that for a lot of the different cardiovascular outcomes and markers, there's very good evidence for impacts of fine particles. And when you look at diesel in particular, so this is a human experiment study on the bottom left where they actually exposed people in a chamber study to diesel or clean air. That's very hard to do these days with IRB. But you can see that individuals who were exposed to diesel, in this case they were measuring markers of myocardial ischemia, so blood flow to the heart. And for those people that were exposed to diesel, there was much more reductions in this case of ST segment depression and ischemic burden compared to those same individuals when they received clean air. So again, this is short-term impacts of diesel on risk factors for cardiovascular health. And finally, there is a bunch of emerging health issues, which you could classify as some evidence for potential impact of diesel. And these range from everything from birth outcomes to obesity, diabetes, and neurological diseases, such as learning disabilities or dementia. So the figure on the bottom right just shows how ultrafine particles, so this is a concern for diesel in particular, where there's a high emission rate of nanoparticles and ultrafine particles, and how they can actually reach the brain directly through the olfactory bulb. And a study was actually able to visualize these nanoparticles within the brain, within brain tissue, which is shown here. So we followed up this study looking at 6.5 million people in Ontario, Canada, and found an association between living near major roads and dementia. So if you lived within 50 meters of a major road, you had a 12% increase in dementia, with that association decreasing to no association once you got to 200 meters. So while this research area is still very much emerging, diesel emissions, and especially resulting nanoparticles, likely play a large role in the exposure of concern. So in summary, there's substantial evidence for the health effects of diesel engine exhaust, but again, stressing that most of this evidence is representing diesel emissions prior to 2007. So these are before there's the particle filters installed. And the health effects from new technology diesel engines are largely unknown. So the Health Effects Institute report, so this is a joint funding agency between the EPA and the auto industry, documented that there are very large reductions in the toxic components. So if you measure what's coming out of new technology diesel, there are vast reductions in air pollution. Animal studies show that there are little health impacts, or the impacts are similar to gasoline exhaust, but there have been few studies and no human studies are available. And with that, here's just some references from the presentation. Thank you. Okay,
thank you. Let's hear from Dr. Lambert first and then take questions. Dr. Lambert, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Dembrow and members of the committee. As you know, my name is William Lambert, and I'm an associate professor in the OHSU's PSU School of Public Health. And I previously have been chair of the Air Quality Control Board at Albuquerque, Bernalillo County in New Mexico, in my previous position at UNM. And then more recently, I chair the Air Toxic Science Advisory Committee for the DEQ, and we provide advice on the scientific principles and concepts needed to make recommendations for air toxics. In in today's testimony to you, I come to you as a scientist. I have to give a disclaimer that these are my views that I'm sharing with you today and don't necessarily represent the views of OHSU or federal agencies that sponsor my research or other connections that I have. I think first I want to impress upon you the complexity of diesel. And I think Dr. Haystad did a wonderful job of providing an overview, but this is a pretty tough thing to think about intervening on in terms of public health, because currently our regulations, if fully enforced and brought forward as intended, I would say are protective of the community's health. And in Oregon, through the meeting the National Ambient Air Quality Standards particulate matter and for the other gases in this complex mixture, we do pretty well at ensuring that the health of everyone in Oregon is protected. But as Chair Dembrough mentioned, there are particular areas where there are going to be concentrations of particular types of vehicle traffic emissions. Dr. Haystad gave, you know, a broad overview for you to show that there's a lot of current research on motor vehicle traffic, but what we can't separate in epidemiologic studies done in general populations is that portion that's of health effects that's attributable to diesel alone. It's in a mixture of air pollution that comes from a variety of sources. And where it becomes difficult for us to think of interventions, and we face this with wood smoke, we face this with cigarette smoke, how do you separate those pollutants from others that are in the air? The Air Toxic Science Advisory Committee is deliberating on exactly these issues. That is there an excess, is there evidence to support an excess risk that's special for diesel particulate matter? And then how would you measure that and enforce it? It's a tough question. So of all of the studies that have been reviewed, and you saw those in previous slides, there are a small group, I would argue, of three or four that are done in occupational settings with people, primarily white men, exposed underground in confined environments to diesel exhaust. And we know their exposure history pretty well through work over time. And it's been measured by industrial hygiene techniques. And we have the ability to see that they're only or primarily exposed to diesel, and we can actually measure that with our scientific tools. And from those studies, as you saw in the summary graph of the dose response curve, we see an elevated risk of lung cancer across a lifetime. And this is important to us. This suggests that diesel is a human carcinogen. And now the International Agency for Research on Cancer, AARC, and other agencies are recognizing at least this as a probable human carcinogen or a human carcinogen. And so what is it that's special about diesel that warrants additional controls over what we have with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards and the air toxics benchmarks that we have in our state? Well, as you've heard, diesel is ultrafine particle, and so it penetrates deep into the lung. It goes past the defenses that we all have. So the ability to filter out particles and protect the deep lung is compromised. For most of us, when we're exposed to larger particles in a size range of say, below 10, many of those particles are deposited in the head, and when you blow your nose or you swallow mucus, it's eliminated from your body. It never gets into the lung, and that's our natural protection against dust exposure, and it works well for air pollutants, too. But for smaller particles that are 2.5 microns, they actually come into the body as you inhale through your nose, and they pass these defenses, and they go into the respiratory tree. They deposit too. That's a size range of 2.5 microns. What we're talking about with diesel is below 0.1 micron. It's a tiny, tiny particle that goes past all these defenses of the mucus, the mucociliary tree, all of that. And through diffusion and sedimentation and impaction, they actually get into the gas exchange regions. And you've heard we can, in our science, see these very small particles be transferred to the heart tissue, the myocardium, or if they're captured in other parts of the respiratory tree, they penetrate to the brain where they're measured. So diesel is special, and that's why we're paying attention to it in the Air Toxic Science Advisory Committee, and we're trying to understand what is that extra risk that's associated with diesel because of this, its unique physical and chemical properties. So all of the research that you heard about today is largely done on old diesel engines. And so these are engines that now have been replaced by new technology, new fuels that are much cleaner, yet there are still a large fleet of old engines on the road. And we don't know a lot about the distribution of these old engines, but it's reasonably argued that some of the older engines are in use in cities in Oregon closer to populations. So in Portland, near rail carrier operations and the transfer points for shipping, those people who live in these areas where older diesel trucks are in use, perhaps because they're no longer in use on long-range interstate transport, are in close proximity to the public. And so in terms of exposure, we're quite concerned about that potential. So in a separate process in the state, the DEQ, with advice from the Air Toxic Science Advisory Committee, will work to set a health standard. But that doesn't preclude, in my view as a public health scientist, taking action in a variety of programs to reduce exposure to diesel, even though we may not be able to precisely measure its health effects, or we're extrapolating information from highly exposed healthy miners in underground environments way back down to our community exposure levels. With smoking, we put forth clean indoor air policies that are very effective to protecting health for everyone. And we don't have a special standard for cigarette smoke. It's not there. And the same for wood smoke, for example. We put into place programs to replace poorly operating stoves and encourage a shift to cleaner burning fuels. Those kinds of things are important in diesel too. Buses, as you've heard, prevent unnecessary exposures to kids. Improving transit, like mass transit, is a great thing to do with clean diesel and their movements there. Encouraging the movement of diesel truck transporters towards clean diesel is also going to be helpful to the population. So the Air Toxic Science Advisory Board will go through its process and will set an air quality standard, or rather an ambient benchmark standard, that really is one piece of the puzzle to encourage movement towards a goal that will be protective. But this is not precluding action potentially on your part to encourage movement towards cleaner diesel engines, and also looking to improve and protect the air quality of communities in small areas that might be especially impacted by heavy diesel use.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Lambert. Let me just ask a question. You, in talking about diesel engines, you can find your remarks to trucks, but we also have off-road diesel equipment that is emitting diesel, and I think it's under the same set of requirements under federal law where engines approximately after 2007 had to have filters, and so buying newer equipment is a way to solve the problem there. Would you, is that true? I mean, your comments really apply both to on-road and off-road.
Yes, my comments would apply to both. And if you look at source partitioning, there are substantial off-road components of emissions, and my comments would apply to that too.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I just have to ask. Now I'm kind of wondering, there's a, I don't know what it's the true term is, but I just refer to it when a diesel pickup truck goes by cyclists and they smoke us out by gunning it and then hitting us. What type of diesel emissions am I getting? Is it because it's a new truck, I don't need to worry about it, or what?
Mr. Chair and Senator Prezansky, I'm a cyclist too. Somebody must have told you that. And I commute daily on my bike, except it was a long ride, so I drove down here. But you're right. In traffic corridors, all of us who are riding in vehicles, walking on sidewalks, or riding a bike are in these areas where there's been limited dilution of these emissions, and we have higher exposures. Currently, studies done in Europe where they look at cyclists like us seem to show that the benefits of the exercise and the use of the bicycle, at least as manifest in terms of life expectancy, are in our favor, even though we're exposed to exhaust from a lot of moving vehicles.
So just more miles on the bike.
More miles on the bike, yeah.
That's my prescription. Thank you. I have to leave right now and get on the bike.
Yes, Senator Robel.
Following up on that, though, what we're really worried about is those very, very small particles getting into the brain. And have we done any studies to find out if those bikers' brains are infected?
I'm twitching.
Dr. Heistad, anything you want to say in response to Dr. Lambert's comments?
Chair Jember, no, I think I agree with most of that. I mean, I think I wouldn't be too focused on is diesel unique. So the regulations in 2007 were put in place because the scientific and policy community thought that there were too much emissions coming out of from those engines. And even if we say it's not unique, it's fine particles, we know that fine particles are harmful to health and that these older diesel trucks are emitting more pollution than maybe the clean diesel. So that in itself, I think, is why some of this legislation is being discussed. And then the second part is diesel that much more hazardous to your health compared to gasoline engine exhaust, for example, or wood smoke? So I think there's a number of reasons for why you might want to focus on old diesels. Right.
Okay, thank you both very much for coming. Okay, our next panel, David Farrer, Sarah Armitage, and Dr. Paul Lewis. Welcome all. I don't know if you all have a preferred order. It's up to you.
Should I go? Okay. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, I'm David Farrer, a public health toxicologist with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm also a member of DEQ's Air Toxic Science Advisory Committee. I'm in part of the committee that Dr. Lambert is chair of, that works to set ambient benchmark concentrations for air toxics in Oregon. I'm here to talk about a lot of what I say will be similar to what you've already heard. I'm here to talk about the health effects of diesel from a public health perspective and to provide additional details about the possible mechanism by which diesel exhaust causes these health effects. Outdoor air pollution, including exposure to diesel exhaust, is linked to a number of health problems. Particle pollution from diesel can increase the risk of cancer, heart disease, asthma attacks, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, and can interfere with the growth and work of the lungs. Some recent studies also indicate that that carbon black, or elemental carbon, which is the core of a diesel particle, can negatively affect cognitive abilities like speech and memory in children. And I also cited the study that Dr. Heistat is author of in talking about the potential link between proximity to roadways and dementia in older adults. The United States Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, recently completed an assessment of benzoapyrene. So benzoapyrene is one of the components of diesel exhaust that is associated with the particulate fraction that adheres to the particle. The assessment found that in animal studies, benzoapyrene can cause fetal death when pregnant mothers are exposed, and can also decrease the ovulation rates in female rats. So those are animal studies, and there isn't yet much evidence of that sort of thing in humans, but EPA felt that those studies were strong enough to use it as the basis for the reference concentration that they have set for benzoapyrene. Now, just to be clear, this is about one specific component of diesel exhaust, and benzoapyrene is also found from other sources, but it is a significant component of diesel exhaust too. So where people live, work, learn, and play matters in their risk of exposure. So exposures are highest where diesel traffic is highest, such as along major highways and in cities. So inhaling particle pollution from diesel makes it harder to breathe, can trigger heart attacks, causes greater use of asthma medication, and causes emergency room visits and hospitalizations for children and adults. I have some Oregon-specific information here. This is mainly about the populations that are most vulnerable to the effects of diesel exhaust, and some numbers that I can put to them. The first group I don't have numbers for, but in general, infants, children, and teens with growing lungs are vulnerable. So that entire population is a particularly vulnerable one. People over the age of 65, and of them, we do know that there's 657,600 in Oregon. Children with asthma, of which there are 81,500 in Oregon. People living with lung disease, such as asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. That first number was just children with asthma, is the 81,000. So if you take all people then you have 11. That's about 11% of the Oregon population has been diagnosed with asthma, and about 5.5% have been diagnosed with COPD. People living with heart disease or diabetes are also particularly vulnerable, and those numbers, 6.7% of Oregonians have some kind of pre-existing cardiovascular disease, and 9.1% have diabetes. I've also included, you can see this in the written testimony easier, I have a table that was created by the Clean Air Task Force. And I got it actually from Kevin Downing at DEQ. But the Clean Air Task Force is a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to reducing air pollution. And they used, they took a national analysis that was done by the EPA, and they scaled it based on population for individual states. And so that's the basis of the numbers that I'm talking about here. And so the EPA's analysis looked at sort of the per capita or per population size estimated numbers of different health outcomes, number of people affected by certain outcomes attributable potentially to diesel. And so that was the national assessment, and then the Clean Air Task Force sort of scaled that based on Oregon's population, what that would mean, you know, sort of multiplied by that factor of Oregon's population. So they estimated 176 premature deaths in adults, 145 non-fatal heart attacks, 25,910 work loss days, 151,000 minor restricted activity days, And then in children, 119 emergency room visits for asthma, 250 acute bronchitis, 3,200 lower respiratory symptoms, and 2,449 for upper respiratory symptoms, and then 5,376 for asthma exacerbation. And again, so I wanted to, that is caveated in that those aren't actual measured numbers in Oregon. That was kind of extrapolated down from a national study. So that we do have significant numbers of vulnerable populations in Oregon, and there's so I'll move on to so I wanted to just end up talking about a little bit about the mechanism of toxicity, and previous testimony has touched on this as well. But diesel exhaust is a mixture of gases and particles. The gases include carbon monoxide, sulfur oxides, nitrogen oxides, alkenes, aromatic hydrocarbons, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or the PAHs, of which benzoapyrene is one that I mentioned before. Several of these gases are carcinogenic. PAHs in particular can cause DNA mutation, which is the first step in a cell becoming cancerous. Benzene is a component of diesel exhaust. Of course, it's also a component of automobile exhaust, but it targets bone marrow and can increase the risk of various blood cancers or leukemias. And then a lot of other gases that are part of it are respiratory irritants. And carbon monoxide is a criteria pollutant, actually, because it can reduce the blood's ability to distribute oxygen. The particles emitted by older diesel engines are perhaps of the greatest public health. So the particles emitted by the older is maybe the component that has the greatest concern. So some of the hazards is simply related to the physical size of the particles. As Dr. Lambert mentioned, it makes it so that they can penetrate deep into the actual respiratory part of the lung where the gas exchange occurs. And once particles get there, it's difficult for the lung to get rid of them. And the process of trying to clear them actually creates inflammation. So that could be the mechanism explaining a lot of the respiratory irritation type components of the health effects, and also because they're so small, they can enter the bloodstream and affect other tissues as well. But it isn't just the physicality of the diesel particles that is the problem. Diesel particles, in particular, are covered with other other chemicals like the PAHs and heavy metals. But one thing that specifically about the PAHs that I think is important is that some of the more potent carcinogenic PAHs, so PAHs is kind of a whole class of chemicals, and they're different sizes and have different potencies. Some of the ones that are heavier or higher molecular weight tend to have the greater potency as far as carcinogenicity. And those are ones they're not very volatile, so they wouldn't on their own they wouldn't like to be in gas phase. But they can become airborne because they adhere to these particles that are airborne. So the particle becomes this vehicle to move this more potent variety of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon into the lung that would not normally get there through inhalation. So that's why that's important. So just in closing, diesel exhaust, particularly from older engines, contains several elements that are harmful to the health of Oregonians, especially the young and elderly among us, and those with pre-existing health problems. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, either now or later, if you have, yeah. Think of things after.
We'll hold off for all three of you. Thanks, Dr. Perry. Mm-hmm.
Great. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. My name's Paul Lewis. I'm the Multnomah County Health Officer. I'm also on the Cleaner Air Oregon Advisory Committee, working on a different but related topic. Also importantly, I've been a pediatrician for 30 years, so I'm going to focus a little bit more on that today. And in pediatrics, we try to prevent kids from getting sick and hurt.
It's interesting, the previous topic was about not getting hurt as well. We want ask parents to do a lot of things, put their kids on their back to go to sleep, wear the bike helmet, use the car seat correctly, et cetera. And all those things, we're asking them to take an individual action. And often they do, because they care about their kids. But there's nothing we can do to get them to prevent exposure of their kids to air pollution. And again, it's only good public policy that can help protect kids in that way. Parents are a little bit helpless that way. You know, children are vulnerable. David mentioned several of the reasons why they're little. They breathe a lot. They're like little birds. They breathe a lot, so they have more stuff going by. And then they also have decades in front of them. And certain diseases, especially heart disease, but especially cancer, take decades to develop. So those exposures in early childhood could actually be particularly important to them. You've heard that, you know, the diesel particulates have been declared a carcinogen by groups like the WHO on shorter timescales. You've heard about asthma attacks, but also lower respiratory tract infections. But another thing that's kind of unique to pediatrics, we also often worry about pregnancy as well, and exposure of the developing fetus, and then with younger children, their exposure of their lungs. And again, we know from studies similar to those that Perry mentioned earlier that lung growth is less if you live in areas with a lot of particulate emission. You'll actually end up growing less lung. So again, these things are of particular importance to us. In 2004, the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a statement about ambient air pollution and focused on diesel in particular, especially around idling vehicles, actually. They also recommended a focus on diesel for both the mobile and then, as you said, the non-mobile sources as well. And you're going to be the first to hear what the updated statement is. Professor Catherine Carr at the University of Washington shared with me just this morning. She's going to be the author of their upcoming statement. And they say there's been a huge expansion in the amount of evidence in the last decade linking early life exposures to many diseases, the list of which I won't go through again. You've heard it all. But especially the behavioral and cognitive things is a new emerging thing of pediatric concern, and that traffic emissions, especially diesel, are particularly important because they're the most important exposure that most children have. And finally, you heard from Professor Lambert about the concentration of particulates in diesel around transportation corridors. So in my role, my Multnomah County hat role, as a major transportation hub for the state, not only for a train, but also trucking, et cetera. This is a particular interest to us. And then we layer on top of that the fact that many of our most vulnerable populations in general, and specifically economically vulnerable populations, are the closest to those corridors. So thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Armitage. I'm with DEQ's Air Quality Planning Section. And thanks for the opportunity to give you a brief overview of DEQ's modeling that we performed as part of our Portland Air Toxic Solutions Project. So this is going to be a little different than the others you've heard from. This is not really about health, but more about data and what we know to date. So when we talk about a model, it's really challenging to provide a quick overview because modeling is a very complex process. So for any of the topics I cover, I'd be happy to get back to members with more detail on our project and further details about the analysis. In addition, my colleague Kevin Downing is here to answer more detailed technical questions about engines and the like. So in the Portland Air Toxic Solutions Project, which DEQ conducted between 2009 and 2011, we took an airshed approach to understanding and reducing air toxics that we have successfully taken to attain particulate, ozone, and carbon monoxide standards across the state. Toxics are more numerous and complex than criteria pollutants, as you've heard, so this was and continues to be a very challenging task. For 19 air toxics, we've estimated for 2017 the cumulative pollutants in the airshed in the Portland area, including those from trucks, wood burning, commercial and industrial activities. We're looking for solutions that reduce pollution from the significant sources throughout the Portland area. And Portland is the first area of the state in which we've done this. We would like to be able to move this approach to other parts of the state as we're able. So with the help of an advisory committee, we arrived at five priority categories, which you can see on the list on the left in the blue box. These are priority categories for reduction in the Portland area. These are the categories, according to our modeling, that are causing the most risk in our area when we look at the region as a whole, and also we look at impacts on neighborhood levels. Two of the categories, heavy-duty diesel vehicles and construction equipment, those are diesel as well, are on the list because of the risk from diesel particulate. There were eight pollutants in this study, including diesel particulate, that we estimated more than 10 times above DEQ's health benchmarks. And these are health protective benchmarks that you've heard from Dr. Lambert already. They're levels of pollutants that people could breathe for a lifetime and have no more than one in a million extra risk of cancer, and then no additional risk of non-cancer health effects like respiratory irritation or nerve damage. And Oregon currently has benchmarks for 52 air toxics, and these are very protective clean air levels. So before I describe the diesel modeling in more detail, I'd just like to mention that there are three types of data on air quality that DEQ collects and develops. Sometimes when I describe our modeling efforts, people think I'm talking about monitoring, so I just wanted to make it clear how these three types of data work hand in hand and give us an accurate picture of air quality. So monitoring is where we sample the air, we analyze it in the lab. It lets us know what chemicals are in the air at very specific locations where our monitors are located. We then compare those results to standards or benchmarks to understand if the levels that we've monitored could be affecting health. This also tells us if there is something further to investigate, and where we've been monitoring for several years in a row or longer, it lets us track trends. So I'd like to note that diesel particulate cannot be accurately monitored, and whole diesel exhaust also cannot be accurately monitored. To date, the only thing we've got available is a type of surrogate monitoring using black carbon that has to be correlated to times of day and likely sources of the black carbon, but is not a direct measurement. So for diesel, we really do rely on modeling. And then our emission inventory, really the third component of our data, is a comprehensive accounting of all emission sources, what they emit, how they emit it. And understanding the sources tells us how emissions could be potentially controlled as well, because we look at the different types of emission sources and we say, you know, what are their control technologies? How do they emit what they emit? What are their emission rates? So we build an emission inventory when we want to do a model. We put it in the model to estimate concentrations of pollutants on a larger scale than we can monitor. Modeling is generally less expensive than monitoring. And then modeling lets us see spatial patterns, relationships, and also lets us make predictions using what-if scenarios. So if we're looking at different types of control technologies or efforts, it can tell us what would be effective. When we get model results, we also compare them to health-based standards or benchmarks to understand potential risks and impacts on public health. And every model has its strengths and weaknesses, as you can imagine. In the model we used in Portland Air Toxic Solutions project, we did some comparisons for locations that we had modeled and also had a monitor on site. And the model performed fairly well for a lot of our pollutants. So we had a good feeling about the model. However, for some chemicals, for a couple chemicals, for metals specifically, it didn't perform very well. And that was, as we realized, we did not have the correct metals information in our emission inventory. So in the Portland Air Toxic Solutions model, we went through these steps. We determined 19 pollutants to include in our model based on their potential to exceed health benchmarks. We then selected a study area based on where people are living, population distribution, where the development is occurring, the city boundaries, urban growth boundaries. We chose the model that best suited our topography and meteorology. It was a model called CalPUF. And then we found and used representative meteorological data to use in the model. This is something you have to do since the model looks at weather patterns, terrain, and it predicts where the pollutants go and what their concentrations are. So we developed an emission inventory for Portland Air Toxic Solutions. That was really our largest task. And then we had to select locations for the model to estimate concentrations. And these were generally the centers of each census block. And in modeling terminology, they're called receptors. So we ran the model. We analyzed it by pollutant. We looked at spatial patterns, and we looked at source categories. We tried to see where were the pollutants coming from and which pollutants and which source categories were causing the most risk. We also compared model concentrations to our air toxics benchmarks, including diesel particulate, to understand estimated risk. And finally, we identified air toxics and sources causing the most risk in the Portland area, and that allowed us to plan for reductions. I'm not going to talk about our activities around anything but diesel, but we have had some good successes working with local government on wood smoke reductions as part of this project. So this is a map of our modeling receptors. I thought it was just interesting to look at because it shows how extensive coverage a model can provide as compared to maybe we've had maybe 5 or 6 monitoring locations in the Portland area for different air toxics. So these are all the locations we modeled for the 19 pollutants in our study. The red dots are the original 1,019 receptors that we placed on the census blocks. And then the blue dots are the additional 1,000 receptors we put in when we wanted better detail for areas with low population. If there wasn't a good census block place to put it, we added receptors. So modeling at the census block level was really good because it allowed us to estimate exposure to populations for the model concentrations and also to use census data, demographic data, to analyze exposure patterns. And we performed an environmental justice analysis. It was the first one we'd done with data that we had generated to look and see if we could determine any disparate impacts. So this map is an example of the results we got out of our model. We have maps like this for every pollutant that we modeled. And this shows estimated risk from diesel particulate. It includes diesel emissions, all the diesel emissions that we could find and put in our emission inventory, on-road engines like trucks, non-road engines like construction equipment. It also included marine emissions, rail, and anything else that we could reasonably include that we had knowledge about. So the risk scale for this map is on the left. The darker red corresponds to higher risk. The darkest shade of red is diesel particulate that's more than 10 times above our clean air benchmark. So in terms of model limitations, we had fairly high quality data for the engine numbers and types of emission locations for our on-road engines emitting diesel particulate. We actually ranked all of our data in this study on an A to E scale, and based on how accurate information we had about the sources, how they emitted the pollution, and where they were located, you know, our certainty on where they emitted. So for non-road or construction diesel particulate emissions, our assessment of data quality was lower because we have a lot less knowledge of these engines, and it's really difficult to know where they're operating. So where are construction engines going to operate? They move around. We could look at zoning, and so that's what we did. We looked at where we thought construction was occurring and the Portland area during the model period. So also for the PATS model, on-road estimates for our model, which we estimated for 2017, which is this year. We did it in 2011, and now it's current. When we did the on-road, the trucks on the road, we used a model, an EPA model, to get to the emissions called Mobile 6.2. That was what we had available at the time. And since we finished the study, a newer EPA model has come out. It's called MOVES. And what we've observed in it is that on-road diesel emissions can be 60 to 70% higher. The results that we have in this model may be a little low based on that. So when we analyzed the highest 20% of the receptors for diesel particulate, we developed emission reduction targets to reach our diesel benchmark. So how far down would we have to go to get to our clean air goal of 1 in a million or the diesel benchmark? And we did this for every pollutant, but for diesel particulate, you can see the reduction target for on-road is 91%, for non-road 93%, and for rail 92%. So I just wanted to briefly show you the table that summarizes our environmental justice analysis that we did on this data. DEQ combined the modeling data with demographic information from the 2010 census to understand if minority or low-income residents may experience greater impact from the air toxics in our study. And this chart summarizes the environmental justice statistical regression. This was one of the methods we used. We used some visual overlays and some other methods, but this chart shows a statistical regression. DEQ's analysis demonstrated that disproportionate impacts from air toxics do occur for minority and low-income populations in the Portland region. Different minority groups and low-income residents are affected by different types of emission sources. The first row across the top shows the primary correlation between populations and a source category. For example, in this chart, the group with the most disparate impact in our study is the Hispanic Latino population, with the most risk from residential wood burning. This analysis showed that minority and low-income populations are disproportionately impacted by diesel engine exhaust also from both on-road and construction equipment. Sensitive individuals such as the young and elderly also suffer impacts from diesel pollution, as you've heard. So that's the information I have, and I'd be happy to take questions as well.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to follow up on this, you know, the issue of the impact on disadvantaged populations. Why exactly is that a problem? Is it harder for people from disadvantaged populations to respond to the health issues that arise from diesel, or is it because of where they live? You know, what is it that calls out particular attention to that population? And really, yeah, any of you?
David Fair is up on this.
Okay. Yeah, so Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I think that is a good question. I think the issue is, there's a couple of things about environmental justice. So the one thing is that, you know, the cheapest places to live are often located in places that are going to have the highest exposure, like near roadways or near other sources of pollution. So oftentimes the people who are getting exposed there can't really, maybe may not be able to afford to live somewhere else, or there may be other reasons besides economics that also would cause people to want to live in those areas. But the other component is, like you said, if you have less access to health care, you may be less likely to catch and to be able to treat an illness that you have effectively. And also, you know, I talk about a lot the kind of the concept of resiliency. Like we all have some level of resilience, and our bodies have built-in mechanisms to repair damage that's caused by environmental insults and clear contaminants that get into us. But those compensatory factors are decreased when you're disadvantaged in other ways. For example, if you have less nutrition, if you have a lower nutrition status, you're not going to be able to repair damage as well as someone who is well nourished. Or if you have, there's also a lot of studies about psychosocial stress. Even there's some great, really clear studies in related to lead in particular, that the same dose of lead given to the like otherwise identical animals in a study will cause a health effect in animals that are stressed besides, and the animals that are not stressed will not have the health effect at the same dose. So that's another component. All of those things. So someone who's living in a community that meets the criteria for environmental justice are likely to be people who have lots of psychosocial stressors besides, they have a lot on their plate besides worrying about pollution. And so they're already, their resilience is less. I think, is that answering your question? And Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I, this is Paul Lewis, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. I think that, as David says, there's almost this cumulative impact of things, and there's this fairly trite phrase, place matters, and it's become almost too easy to identify almost any health outcome being bad based on where someone is. And when this new information from the last decade that's come out around causing cancer, causing heart disease, causing dementia, which all have disparities based on place and advantage, you have to wonder, is ambient air pollution one of the many factors that's contributing to that? And I would argue, since people like David can actually do experiments and prove these things, that DNA is being damaged and lung cells aren't growing, that making that connection between the exposure and the health outcome is actually quite a bit stronger for things like ambient air than for some of the other topics.
Yeah, and I would also think that any one of these can be a problem. Any two of them become more of a problem. And there is an additive nature, and if your environment is also has other pollutants in it, your body can only handle so much. So I think there is that in some of these places as well. And you had mentioned earlier that parents can put helmets on, they can do all those other things, but there's not much they can do about there. I disagree, because I think they can come live on the coast and live on the west side, or on the west side of the road. And generally speaking, the air is really good. So I'm just, so there are things you can do, and I would encourage a lot of people to come to the coast. It's a great place. And if you can't live there, it's always good to vacation and come and clean your lungs out once in a while.
There is a center role in the challenge of dairy air.
I didn't say you had to go to
Tomah.
I would like you to go to Tomah, yes. But you don't have to.
That's maybe a topic we will come back to in this committee.
The north part of Tomah. Right?
And, the north part of Tomah, yeah. Well, actually, the wind blows enough a lot of times that even dairy air, you just stay to the beach. Go to the beach.
So I do have a question about the relationship between modeling and monitoring, going back to that. I often hear modeling referred to, almost as if it's fake news, it's because it's modeled that means it's not real. It's something that somebody comes up with to support a prefigured notion. So I wonder if you could say something about the relationship between modeling and monitoring, the way that it kind of goes back and forth, and the way the model is updated according to the monitoring results.
Yes, Senator Dembro, that's exactly how we would characterize it as well, is the information, it goes back and forth between the two bodies of knowledge. Modeling is really critical for DEQ to understand what's going on in an airshed. And, their EPA developed models that we use to understand pollution problems across the state with regard to federal standards on particulate and ozone that are good enough to base compliance on. So, a lot of the models have been well developed over the years, and they're refined, they have good inputs. Even if you have a model and you say compare it to monitoring results and they're not the same, that tells you something as well. And that's actually how we started looking for metals from glass facilities, because there was a difference between the two. But so once we get a model, it can help us place our monitors. And we've actually used the Portland Air Toxic Solutions model to look at placing an air toxics monitor in Hillsborough, which ran for 2 years, and also we've placed one in Gresham recently. So it's really a key partnership between those two types of data, and then the emission inventory is also key to do a good model.
Okay, thank you. So with that, I think we're going to have to end, because we have another committee coming. Yeah.
My committee.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, right. We can. We'll just take as much time as we need.
That's right. The thing that I think that I get frustrated with about modeling is people want to discredit modeling, which is easy to do if you take any particular place at any particular time and say, is it giving me the right answer here? Because that was not what it's designed for. And I get frustrated that we try to answer all questions. Some people think that models answer all questions, and they don't really do that. I mean, that's not what their design is. And my biggest one lately has been with people in global warming. The global warming models are models. They don't tell you what's going to happen today in Coos Bay, Oregon. And they never were intended for that. But they do tell you over time what may happen. And I think we're getting better at it. My great story for a lot of stuff is an old scientist that I had a good fortune to meet in at MIT when I was there for a program with our school. And he was the person that helped design the intercontinental ballistic missile system and didn't want it to ever fail, so they had a lot of redundancy in it. And he'd gotten this big computer, so he decided to do a model on it. At that time, the federal government was deciding to put in these low-cost housing units all over the country in large cities. And so he put it in his model just to see what it would do. And then he went to Congress for the next 40 years to explain to them, here's my original model. It told you this would be the demise of inner city, because if you don't do things differently than that, if you put everybody there that doesn't have the skills necessary to work as a community, you are going to destroy the inner city. And it just drove him crazy that no one listened to his model. They did at the end, but it was really, really late. And he said, you know, models do a really good job of predicting future things if you have the right data. They aren't necessarily at any one moment very good at anything. That's not what they were designed for. And I think we go back and forth with that, and that's how people try to dismiss things, because, oh, today is really warm. It must not be, you know, it maybe is global warming. Oh, tomorrow is really cold. It's been a pretty cold winter, so obviously there's no global warming going on. It's frustrating that people don't understand how models work and how they're developed and the kinds of stuff that gets put into them. And I have never met a person who is in charge of a model that was ever satisfied. And people forget that they keep working on them. Every time they run it, they look at it, is there something I could tweak to make it a little bit better? And I think we forget that too.
Thank you, Senator. I can think of no better way to end this hearing. So thank you, everyone who came here. I'm going to close the informational meeting. With that, this committee will be adjourned until next Monday. And again, we will be diesel bill will be introduced next week, and it'll become part of the public debate. So with that, we are adjourned. Public debate. So with that, we are adjourned.